Hi, Professor. My name is Ryan Cunningham, and I'm a first-year student at the Kennedy School. You sort of ended your speech with a big blank, and I want to give you the chance to fill it. I'm very curious to know, what else could the government be doing, and as private citizens, what can we really do to be effective in letting the government know how we feel?
Government can do. The easiest thing that the government can do is, it's kind of like asking, if suppose you had a battered wife in front of you, and you ask, well, what else can a husband do? Well, you know, one thing you can do is stop battering her. Okay, that's one possibility. That's a pretty straightforward one. And as I said, the burden of proof is all, you're asking the wrong question. The burden of proof is on those who advocate violence. You don't need an argument against them. Okay, they got to give the argument. So what can the government do? Well, it can do what the rest of the world wants, for example. It can stop desperately trying to block inspections. And it can go along with allowing inspections. Okay, that's one thing it could do. If they really believe everything they're saying, and I doubt that they do, there are other simple proposals. I mean, I could suggest a couple. They're never discussed, but there are simple proposals. But the easiest one is just to allow the inspectors back. They've done far more to eliminate Saddam's weapons than bombing did, or sanctions. I mean, the inspectors had a big effect. They're not going to find everything. You know, in fact, you can't find everything. It's a lot when Rumsfeld says, we can't be sure they'll find everything, he's surely correct. I mean, if a country has a high school biology lab, it probably has the capacity to develop biological weapons. Okay, so you can't. So the only way to find everything is destroy the entire country. Okay. But nuclear weapons development is very easy to detect. So if that's what anyone's concerned about, yeah, you can handle that. There's just the world's intelligence agencies have a very strong case when they say that Saddam Hussein, the likelihood that he'll be involved in inciting or even supporting terrorist acts is extremely low. If you're worried about nuclear weapons being put together in a New York hotel room, which is not impossible. In fact, there are technical papers in the literature 4 or 5 years ago saying that things like that have a far higher probability of success than a missile attack. If you're worried about that, then worry about the loose nukes in the world, like in former Soviet Union or in Pakistan, which is a really serious threat. But since the people in Washington they don't care about that threat very much, they're not doing it. So yes, there are easy things to do like that. And then, as I say, there are also other, if war is necessary, there are simple, much easier proposals than what's suggested.
Sir, my name is Rick Arthur. I'm a student here. I like to call you on your Perforakian call to inaction always. You advocated inaction in the face of the genocide in Bosnia and in several other incidences that are similar to that.
Can you refer to some place where I referred to inaction?
Well,
in Bosnia?
But Bosnia was one.
Can you refer to a place where I did that?
You called for inaction.
Can you mention a place where I called for inaction? Can you cite a source?
Well, I don't have an information.
No, you
of me.
Don't have one because none exists. What you're doing is paying attention to gossip that you hear from various columns.
I'd like to bring you to the light you bear when you talk about the damage that terrorism causes. Terrorism causes dramatic instability in the Pacific. It's caused dramatic instability in New York, and that has dire economic effects.
That's absolutely right. That's why I've been opposed to terrorism for years. I was arguing against the, 20 years ago, I was writing about the Reagan administration's massive terrorist wars, and I continue to do it up till today.
Why don't you ask your question, though?
What concrete steps would you advocate the United States do as a superpower to combat terrorism? Besides nothing.
Right. Well, first of all, one easy way to reduce terrorism, the easiest possible way, is to stop participating in it. That already reduces it by a very substantial factor. Huge, in fact, right up to the present. I'll give you, if you don't know examples, I'll be glad to list them for you. Second, if to talk about that small, much smaller category of terrorism that's directed against the West, Okay, and it exists, and it's serious. Let's say Al-Qaeda-style terrorism. Well, of course, one way to stop, to reduce it is to stop fostering it. So remember where these groups came from. These are the groups that were organized, trained, and armed by the CIA back in the 1980s and their associates to fulfill for reasons of state. They didn't care about Afghanistan. As late as 1993, after the first attempt to blow up the World Trade Center, which came awful close to succeeding, Bill Clinton was sending Al-Qaeda members, or, you know, at least Afghanis, Islamic radicals from Afghanistan, along with Hezbollah people, flying them to Bosnia to fight the U.S. side in that war. Well, you know, that one way to, and we can go on with that. Bali bombing is another case if you want to look at it closely. So another way to reduce terrorism is to stop fostering and organizing terrorists around the world. But let's take the attacks against the United States, okay, like 9/11. How do you deal with that? Well, you know, one way of dealing it is by bombing Afghanistan, which, as far as anyone, according to U.S. intelligence at least, had almost no effect on terrorism and may have extended it. That's U.S. intelligence. There are ways, however, to reduce threats like that, and we know what they are. They've been carried out for careful police work. So, for example, primarily in Germany, which is the leader in this, police work has, in fact, broken up a very significant Al-Qaeda rings. And yeah, that's the way you deal with crimes. The other way you deal with them, and everyone knows this, is by looking at the grievances. You want to deal with terrorism? Every serious scholar, the head of every intelligence agency, anyone who has their head screwed on, knows that you do with it by looking at where it comes from. If you want, I can quote for you the head of Israeli Shabak and the head of Israeli military intelligence and leading scholars here and so on. Yeah, they all say the same thing, just as Britain finally found out. You want to deal with IRA terrorism, there's no use, wouldn't do any good to bomb Belfast or to bomb Boston, for example, where the financing came from. What made sense, first they tried violence, that just increased the terrorism. Finally, they started paying some attention to the grievances, which are quite real. And there's been some progress, and that's true all over. So yeah, there are a lot of ways to deal with terrorism, but the main way is to stop participating in it.
My name's Shahe Wartanian. I'm an undergraduate. Before I say anything, I want to thank you for all your books you've written. They're quite prolific, and my friends and I, you know, we sit around reading them, and we enjoy it very much.
So you got better things to do than that.
what I wanted to say was that I've been reading a number of articles on this question of whether, you know, we ought to go to war or not. And I read a piece that said that, you know, Hussein has gone into the north and executed a lot of the Kurdish folks that are up there and that commits genocide up there, and that the link to terrorism resides with the fact that he gives $25,000 to the families of suicide bombers, so that there's a monetary link there. You're asking about a connection. So I would say that it resides with
those two things. So let's take those two things.
Go
ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It's those two that he's broken United Nations resolutions, undermined international law, that the war with Iran and Kuwait, that he's, destabilized the region, and that it's...
Yeah, I'm familiar with
the
argument.
Case for war.
So what is the question?
Wrote that,
yeah.
But
what does one say about those things?
Yeah,
okay. So let's go through them. So it's perfectly true. Let's go back to the main arguments that are given. I mean, every speech of Blair and Bush and the British dossier, or let's take the New York Times a couple of days ago, which had a big insert taken from the Kennedy School, incidentally, from a Kennedy School research project on crimes of Saddam Hussein. And what was charged is all correct. Only one thing is missing in all of these accusations. Three little words, with our support. Okay. Yeah, he invaded Iraq. He used chemical weapons in the war. He used gas against what's called his own people. The Kurds are his own people in the sense that the Cherokees were Andrew Jackson's people. But yeah, he used gas against the Kurds. He then carried out the Anfal massacre, which maybe killed 100,000 of them or so, always with the firm support of the United States and Britain. okay? In fact, of the people who are now in charge, who don't even have the minimal decency to say, well, we did something wrong. What they do is leave out the words, "with our support," and everyone who reports it leaves out the words, "with our support," which continued, including giving him means to develop weapons of mass destruction, missiles, nuclear weapons, biological and chemical weapons, and all that went on literally up to the day of the invasion of Kuwait. And in fact, he did invade Kuwait when he was a U.S. ally, just as he invaded Iran when he was a U.S. ally. So yeah, he committed all of those crimes, and those are by far the worst crimes in his record, with our support. The next worst crimes on his record are in March 1991, after the war, right? After the Gulf War, when there was a Shiite uprising, which probably would have overthrown him. There were rebelling Iraqi generals who didn't ask the U.S. for support. Remember, that's the time when the U.S. had total control of the region, total. You know, it's after the war. But the people who are now in Washington decided to support their old friend Saddam. So they refused to allow rebelling Iraqi generals access to captured arms. They authorized Saddam to use military helicopters and other weapons, and he killed tens of thousands of more people while they watched. And they had a reason, an official reason. They said the reason is because we need what's called stability. We want to make sure that Iraq doesn't break up. It was explained rather well by the chief diplomatic correspondent of the New York Times, well and approvingly, Thomas Friedman. He said the best of all worlds for the United States would be an iron-fisted military junta ruling Iraq the same way Saddam did, but with a different name, because this one's kind of embarrassing. And those are his worst crimes by far. Did he violate UN resolutions? Sure, you know, he's hardly the only one. People point out correctly that Israel's violated many more, but that's missing the point. Think for a minute. If Iraq had the capacity to veto Security Council resolutions, it wouldn't be in violation of any of them. I mean, the main way to violate Security Council resolutions is to veto them. And who's in the lead in vetoing Security Council resolutions? Ever since the UN fell out of control with decolonization, so say since the 1960s, well, the U.S. is far in the lead, Britain second, nobody else is even in shouting distance. And it's on all kinds of issues. So, for example, the U.S. is the only country on record as vetoing a resolution calling on all states to observe international law. Okay, that was after the U.S. had rejected the World Court ruling ordering it to stop its terrorist attacks against Nicaragua. So, yeah, there are plenty of countries that are in violation of Security Council resolutions. That's true. Does it have anything to do with attack on Iraq? No, nothing. Let me just add one word, because I forgot to talk about the alleged $25,000 to suicide bombers. That may or may not be true. I've never seen a source for it, but let's say it's true. Before there were any suicide bombers, was also reported by the same sources that Saddam Hussein was giving $10,000 to the families of anyone who was killed by Israeli atrocities, and there were plenty of them. Well, should he have been doing that? So let's take, say, the first month of the current Intifada. I'm just relying now on IDF sources, Israeli army sources. What they say is that in the first few days of the Intifada, the Israeli army fired 1 million bullets, okay? One of the high military officers said that means one bullet for every child. Within the first month of the Intifada, they killed about 70 people, okay, using U.S. helicopters. And in fact, Clinton shipped new helicopters to Israel as soon as they started using them against civilians. That's just the first month. And at that point, and it goes on, no suicide bombers. At the time, it was reported that Saddam Hussein was giving $10,000 to every family. Well, is that supporting terror? I mean, it seems to me sending helicopters to Israel when they're using them to attack apartment complexes, that's supporting terror.
Lucy Nesbitt from the Kennedy School. Could you please discuss the doctrine of Pax Americana as an organizing principle for U.S. foreign policy?
You're referring, for example, to the National Security Strategy report from a month ago. That was a pretty brazen, which everybody knows it, so I don't have to repeat it. It was a pretty brazen statement, and it's part of the reason why much of the world, including Europe, regards the United States as a menace to itself and the world, to quote Levin again. Yeah, it's part of the reason. It frightened the Europeans and others. On the other hand, if you think about it, Colin Powell pointed out in a press conference right afterwards that it wasn't all that new, and that even the preemptive strike doctrine, he said, was not all that new, and he was correct. It's an old principle, and the U.S. didn't invent it, of course. It's just the U.S. is by far the most powerful state, so when it proposes it, it means something. But you can trace it right back to the time when the U.S. became a major global power after the Second World War. Before that, it was also true, but in the region, that's called the Monroe Doctrine, in fact. It goes back to the, in fact, when Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, 40 years ago, ordered his staff to unleash the terrors of the earth against Cuba, escalating an already ongoing international terrorist campaign. The reason was that, you can read it in the declassified record now, the reason was that the very existence of the Castro regime was a successful defiance of the United States and of a policy of 150 years that the United States had been following. Namely, it was the existence of a regime which was not following U.S. orders. And they traced it back 150 years, so therefore we had to carry out a major terrorist campaign that goes right into the 1990s. So yeah, Colin Powell's correct. It's not new. And furthermore, it's even on the public record. You don't have to go to the declassified record. So if we go back again 40 years, since I'm talking about the Kennedy School, to the Kennedy administration, in 1962 or 63, right about then, 62, I think, senior statesman and Dean Acheson, and senior Kennedy advisor, gave an important speech to the American Society of International Law. He was talking about the U.S. Economic warfare against Cuba, which was widely recognized as illegal, and by now every relevant body, including even the normally compliant Organization of American States, has declared it to be illegal. At the time, the terrorist war was already underway, but it wasn't that public, except of course Cubans who knew all about it. What he told the American Society of International Law, that in the case of a U.S. response, he said that no legal, I'm quoting it now, no legal issue arises, no legal issue in the case of a U.S. response to a challenge to its power, position, or prestige. Okay, that actually goes beyond the Bush Doctrine announced a month ago, and that's the other end of the spectrum. That's the Kennedy administration, okay? And that was public, like it's not secret. It's the American Society of International Law. And there are plenty of examples in between. The same is true of preemptive strikes. The idea of a preemptive nuclear strike, which was kind of announced, you know, not in those words, but everyone understands it in the so-called Bush Doctrine. It's also a Clinton Doctrine. Have a look at the major study of Clinton's Strategic Command, which is from 1995. It's called Essentials of Post-Cold War Deterrence, partially declassified. It's the major document sort of working out a post-Cold War strategy. Well, one of the things it advocates is what it calls preemptive response. It's a nice phrase, you know, think about it. Preemptive response, including nuclear weapons, against non-nuclear states that have signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, if considered necessary. Okay. It also explains the background. It says we have to convey a national persona of being irrational and vindictive. That, they say, will frighten people. In the professional literature of political science and international relations is a term for it. It's called establishing credibility. That's very important. You've got to establish credibility. You know, you want to know what that means, ask your neighborhood mafia don. I'll explain to you what it means. You don't just collect protection money from somebody if they don't pay. You certainly don't ask for a court order for it. What you do is beat them to a pulp. That establishes credibility. Then others know who's boss. And that's the way international relations work, too. So, yeah, there's a direct precedent there, and you can trace it back quite far.
Hello, I'm John Mensing. I'm a first-year MPP here at the Kennedy School. And we've talked a lot tonight about the U.S.'s motivations here, kind of cynical, but we'll accept them for the purpose of discussion. I really want to talk about the relevant question here is the world going to be a better place if Saddam is out of power? Regardless of our motivations behind this regime change, wouldn't we still be better off if this, by all accounts, sort of nasty guy was out of power?
Absolutely. We would also be better off if a regime was out of power, which is regarded widely in the world, including Europe, as a menace to itself and to the world. Yeah, we'd be better off. And in fact, there are plenty of very brutal regimes around the world. You want me to start naming them from A to Z? Yeah, plenty of them. Saddam Hussein is certainly a threat to anyone within his reach, just as he was when the current people in Washington were offering him lavish support and incidentally explaining the reasons. It had nothing to do with the Cold War, it had nothing to do with the war against Iran. It was because of our duty to support American exporters, as John Kelly, the State Department head of the Middle East Affairs, testified in the early 1990. Yeah, that's why we had to do it. And then he was a real danger when we were... So yes, it would be better, the world would be better off if a lot of regimes were out of power. I can list plenty of them. And some of them are pretty close to home. But what does that have to do with this? I mean, if we want to get rid of Saddam Hussein, there are easier ways to do it. In fact, there are easier ways by war. Much easier ways.
Could you enlighten us on those easier ways?
Perfectly obvious one. I mean, let me point out before I even mention it that this suggestion is totally insane. Its only merit is that it's a lot more reasonable than what's being discussed. So one possibility is to unleash Iran. We can offer them logistic support and missiles and bombing, all from a safe distance. Let them do the fighting. That has lots of advantages over what's being proposed. For one thing, just think about them for a minute. They'll not only get rid of Saddam, they'll tear him to shreds and everybody who's anywhere near him. They'll eliminate every trace of weapons of mass destruction, which really threaten them. And furthermore, they'll do it for any successor regime, which the U.S. won't do. So therefore, they'll make a real contribution to disarmament in the region. And in fact, they'll even live up to a paragraph of the famous Resolution 687, which is always omitted when it's reported, namely the Article 14, which says that disarming Iraq should be part of general disarmament in the region. Okay, that makes sense. And by disarming successor regimes to Saddam, yeah, there'll be a big help there. Another advantage is there won't be any American casualties. Okay, there won't be any Israeli casualties. Nobody will be, no point shooting off scuds at a country at Israel when its prime enemy is invading. That would be ridiculous. So no casualties, that's fine. There are plenty of Iraqi and Iranian casualties, but that can't possibly be a concern. I mean, the U.S. was, these guys in Washington were supporting massive Iranian and Iraqi casualties in the 80s. They continued through the 90s. Saddam would use chemical weapons, but again, that can't be a concern. We not only supported him when he did it in the past, but continued to aid him in developing more. In fact, as I said, continued to help him develop weapons of mass destruction well after, so that can't be it. And no problems with the UN. You don't have to go through all that nonsense. If anybody bothered to stop the liberation of Iraq, the U.S. could veto it as usual, but it wouldn't come up anyway. There's no question that Iranian troops would probably be welcomed in a large part of the country. Remember, most 60 or 65% of the country is Shiite, not pro-Iranian, but they're much more likely to be welcoming Iranian troops than U.S. troops. In fact, on Basra and Karbala, they'll be shouting from the rooftops, thanking the liberators, and we can all join the Iranian journalists who are writing about the liberation and the noble effort and opening a new era of humanitarian intervention. We can all join in on that. We're spared the embarrassment of pretending that our leaders have suddenly gone through a miraculous conversion for which there isn't a particle of evidence. They'll be able to do much better than we in introducing democracy in Iran, in Iraq. I mean, the U.S. is going to have a big problem with making sure that the large majority of the population has essentially no voice. If we want to talk about the Kurds, they'll be in trouble. But the U.S. has a horrendous record with regard to Kurds. Most recently in Turkey, where the U.S. was right through the Clinton, in the Clinton administration, some of the worst atrocities of the 1990s were being carried out in southeastern Turkey, where millions of people were driven from their homes, tens of thousands were killed, every barbaric form of torture you can imagine. In the single year 1997 alone, the Clinton administration sent more arms to Turkey than in the entire Cold War period combined, up to the onset of what is called, for example, in the Boston Globe this morning, the counter-terror campaign. The counter-terror is what we call our terrorism, right? So if you read the Globe this morning, there's a little insert about the success of the counter-terror campaign. Yeah, it was this. So, you know, asking us to save the Kurds, that's not very substantial. And so on. So what's the matter with that? Well, you know, and in fact, why isn't it being discussed? 1 second. Notice it isn't being discussed. And there's a very good reason for it. It's crazy. I mean, it's totally crazy. But it's just a lot more reasonable than what is being proposed. And in fact, think it through in your spare time. There's only one flaw in this proposal. The flaw is it's not going to leave the United States in control of Iraqi oil, and it's not going to solve the domestic political problems of the reactionary right-wing oligarchy. Other than that, I don't see any flaws in it. So if those...
We have a distinguished fellow here at the Institute of Politics, one Ted Sorensen, and he would like to ask you a question.
Professor, you were quite successful a while back in embarrassing the young questioner who didn't have specific citations to back up his questions to you. But when you come to the Kennedy School and attack John F. Kennedy, I'm listening. Mm-hmm. In two instances, you made two instances. First, you tried to charge Kennedy with a speech given by Dean Acheson to the international lawyers.
I said a senior, remember what I said, a senior advisor of
he
the Kennedy.
He was not a senior advisor. He held no position in the Kennedy administration.
No, but he was an advisor.
And you ought to have facts.
He was an advisor. He was an advisor to the Kennedy administration.
No, he was not. Right. The only advice he gave, okay, the only advice he gave, which I quoted on this platform 2 weeks ago, Kennedy totally rejected.
Okay.
Secondly, you said Kennedy gave an order to his White House staff to let everything loose against Cuba.
No, that's not what I said. I said to unleash.
He never gave any such order.
Unleash.
If you're talking about Operation Mongoose, that was an operation by the CIA that was not authorized by Kennedy. And in a Cuba conference 2 weeks ago, speaking to Cubans about Operation Mongoose, I pointed out what Kennedy's actual principles and policies were, and I said to the extent that Operation Mongoose violated its mandate and went beyond Kennedy's policies and principles by inflicting violence, I apologize.
Shall we go through Operation Mongoose? The phrase terrors of the earth I happen to take from the main scholarly source on the U.S. and Cuba, Piero Glagesis's recent study, Conflicting Missions, which is quoting the declassified record and quotes Kennedy as ordering his staff to unleash the terrors of the earth against Cuba because of what I said, its successful defiance of the United States, namely the very existence of the regime is a successful defiance of the United States, and so on, as I quoted. Operation Mongoose was not an Eisenhower administration operation. It was not a CIA operation, but you know better than I do that the CIA is just the way that the executive branch maintains plausible deniability. They don't do anything on their own. This was a Kennedy, not only a Kennedy operation, but it was violent and brutal. We have an extensive declassified record on that by now. We can go through it if you like. And was going on right up to the Cuban Missile Crisis, right before it. In fact, one of the Operation Mongoose, I won't even go into this, but it continued beyond. And in fact, 10 days before the assassination, Kennedy ordered new terrorist operations and more extensive ones. If you want, I'll set you the sources, but it's all through you can't deny it anymore because it's all in the declassified record.
I think he wants to make one response to this and then we'll go on to other people. Mr. Sorensen. We'll stay here. Do you want to make one response to this, sir?
Yes. What we just heard was also false.
Shh. Go ahead. You want to respond, Mr. Sorensen? Something new?
Well, I'd be glad if Professor Chomsky will send to me a record in which President Kennedy made such a statement.
Well, I'll give you the footnote right now.
No, it's, I'm not in. I want to see an actual record.
Okay. You can write a letter to Pierre Iglesias and ask him. Actually, he cites Arthur Schlesinger on that.
All right, let's move on. This is probably taken on enough.
And as
this
you know, he's one of the leading scholars who deals with these issues.
All right.
Oh, sure, we do. And okay. I've read the classified record, and so have you, and you know the truth about it.
Let's get a little order here now. This gentleman up here, okay?
If you'd like, I'll be happy to send you the exact reference. Just write me an email, and I'll be happy to send you the exact reference. I can't give you the page in my memory. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Farouk Hadid. I'm a first year at the Graduate School of Business. The question that I have actually concerns the Iraq debate, and the question I have is, I'd like to know what your thoughts are on the long-term consequences for Arab cohesion and identity in the aftermath.
Sorry, I didn't catch it. The long-term consequences?
Of Arab cohesion.
Arab cohesion.
And identity in the aftermath of a war or further an occupation, a long-term occupation of Iraq. As an Arab, this concerns me because I'd like to know what consideration is being given, if any, to preserving the identity and strengthening the nationalism in a post-war region.
You're speaking of Iraq specifically or the Arab world?
Start with the people that are going to get occupied.
Well, you know, it's anybody's guess. I mean, once you start a war, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there's plenty of historical evidence on that. The CIA doesn't know, Rumsfeld doesn't know, I don't know, nobody knows. You unleash a major war, all kinds of things can happen. If we look at the historical record for a guide, we know what the U.S. record has been, not only in the Middle East, but right close to home, Latin America. We've got, as I quoted the Kennedy administration declassified record, we've got a policy of 150 years. And we can look at what that's done. So we can take a look, say, at the country that has had the most has been the beneficiary, let's say, of the most U.S. intervention in the 20th century, ever since Woodrow Wilson invaded, namely Haiti, which is the poorest country in the hemisphere. And the intervention goes right through the 90s, supporting terror. In fact, a leading terrorist is now hiding out in Queens, and the U.S. won't extradite him. Emmanuel Constant, head of the group that killed maybe 4,000 people in the early 90s, and everyone knows why they won't extradite him. He's going to spill the beans on U.S. involvement with the terrorist forces. So that's Haiti, the most intervention. The second most intervention in the 20th century has been Nicaragua, which is now the second poorest country in the hemisphere. Vying with it in second place is Guatemala, which is also vying in second place for most intervention, and we can run through the record. In the Middle East, we have a long record. So, in fact, again, the declassified record is extremely illuminating, and it, again, takes some discipline not to look at it. So George Bush, you remember his plaintive question, why do they hate us, because we're so good, and so on and so forth. He wasn't the first president to ask that question. That was raised by President Eisenhower in 1958 in internal discussion, where he discussed with his staff what he called the campaign of hatred against us by the people in the Arab world. And the National Security Council gave an analysis of it and gave a reasonable answer. They said it's based on the recognition, I'm mixing up a couple of things from 1958, they're not day after day. In 1958, the National Security Council pointed out, discussed what they called the recognition in the Arab world that the United States supports harsh and oppressive regimes and blocks democracy and development because of our interest in controlling Near East oil. And they recommended more of the same. And it continues right up to the present. We don't have a declassified record from last year, but we have a public record. So after September 11th, some of the better journals, like the Wall Street Journal, to their credit, did try to do some studies of opinions of the parts of the Arab world that they care about, the rich people. So they had a study of what they called moneyed Muslims, meaning bankers and, you know, lawyers and managers of multinationals and so on, all people who are right involved in the whole American system, you know, no objections to U.S.-style globalization or anything else. And they gave the same answers as in 1958. They said, yeah, there's we admire the United States, we like its values, we love its freedom, but we wish you wouldn't deprive us of them. What we oppose is the U.S. policies of supporting oppressive and brutal governments and blocking democracy and development. I mean, that's now exacerbated by particular policies that didn't exist in the 1950s, but those are constant strains. And you hear it right now in, you know, Pakistan, Egypt, anywhere you look, same complaints. So is that a basis for thinking that the democracy is going to be established? Well, you know, again, you can believe in religious conversion and have blind faith in your leaders, but other than that, I don't see any basis.
Hi, my name is David Goldstein. I'm in the MPAID program here at Kennedy School. My views tend to fall on the center left in the spectrum of things, but for the sake of discussion, you made an interesting point in your talk, which is that the real reason we're going into Iraq, or the administration wants to go to Iraq, is to get the oil. That's this biggest material prize that exists in the world. And I tend to agree with you. I think that
one of the biggest material prizes.
One of the biggest.
In world history, yeah. That's the State Department, incidentally. That's not me. Yeah.
So if you accept that to be true, which I do, isn't there a certain calculus that someone who's sitting in the shoes of a Condoleezza Rice could make, that they're responsible for the best outcome for American citizens, and there's an upside of going into Iraq, which is we get this greatest material possession, one of the greatest material possessions in the world history. And there are downsides, which are we upset the international community and maybe there's more terrorism. And couldn't you envision a calculus where they say, sure, that's the reason, and it's a good reason, let's do it. What's the flaw in the calculus?
Oh, I think that's exactly their calculus. But then we ought to just be honest and say, look, we're a bunch of Nazis. So fine, let's just drop all the discussion. You know, we save a lot of trees, and we can throw out the newspapers and most of the scholarly literature, and just come out, state and straight, and tell the truth. You know, say we'll do whatever we want because we think we're going to gain by it. And incidentally, it's not American citizens will gain. They don't gain by this. It's narrow sectors of power, domestic power, that the administration is serving with quite unusual dedication. Yeah, they'll gain. So, you know, Dick Cheney will gain, Halliburton will gain, so on and so forth. American high-tech industry will gain. So, for example, one of the ways of recycling petrodollars is selling arms. Now, that's misleadingly called the military-industrial complex, but anybody who looks carefully, certainly anybody who works at MIT, where it pays our salaries, knows perfectly well that the military system is kind of a cover for high-tech industry. I mean, anyone who's using a computer or telecommunications or the internet or, you know, gets benefits from automation or containerization or you just name it. I mean, it's all, a lot of it's coming out of the state sector of the economy, which is very dynamic and innovative. It operates under the cover of military spending quite often. So there's kind of gains that sort of dribble down. But if that's what we're interested in, fine, let's just say it instead of all the lying.
My name is Joe Pace. I'm a freshman from the college. In July of this year, a group of bipartisan senators issued forth what was fortunately an unsuccessful call for regime change in Iran. And since Iran is also a fellow axis of evil state, what do you think the possibility is that this slogan, peace through Baghdad, will turn into peace through Tehran? And if so, what do you think the justifications that we'd fabricate for that would be?
Well, actually, I quoted Anthony Cordesman before, urging the, who remember is a very conservative mainstream military strategist. I quoted him as warning the administration not to follow the sillier armchair strategists who happen to be right close to the power now. And that's what one of the things they're calling for. Now, we don't know, here's what, we do know something about this. Israel has basically become virtually a U.S. military base by now. And it's a small country, but as an offshoot of the Pentagon, more or less, It has an extremely powerful military. According to the IDF analysts, you know, the Israeli army analysts, the Israeli Air Force and Navy are larger and technologically more advanced than those of any NATO power, any other than the United States, of course. And right now, apparently, over 10% of the air and naval forces are permanently based in Turkey, in big U.S. bases in eastern Turkey. And armored forces are there, too, presumably to help in case it's necessary to continue the atrocities against the Kurds in the region, if they stand up again. What are they doing there? Well, according to American scholarly sources, like Robert Olson in the Middle East Policy recently, they're flying over at the Iranian border, looking ahead to the next stage. Iraq's kind of small, you know, you can smash that up easily. But Iran is big. That's Israel's main enemy, because they know that that's the one country in the region that they can't easily dominate militarily, so they've been trying to get the U.S. to do it for them for years. And that apparently is going on. And he and others also report that there are plans in the offing to try to partition, to work to partition Iran, maybe by stripping off the northern Azerbaijani regions, mostly Azeri up there, and other plans. Well, you know, how accurate that is, we don't know, but they're certainly thinking about it. And again, if you read the Israeli press, which is very informative on this and quite reliable, particularly has been for a long time, very informative now because of the close connections between the you know, the Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl circles and the ultra-right in Israel. So they're reporting it extensively. Yeah, these are exactly the kind of plans they have in mind, but they're much broader. I mean, they also talk about plans to extend the Hashemite kingdom, Jordanian kingdom, to part of Iraq and part of Saudi Arabia, reconstruct the whole region in a kind of an Ottoman style, you know, with the centers of power being in Ankara and Jerusalem, of course, all under the U.S. aegis, and regional, you know, you leave regional affairs to local people, pretty much the way the Ottoman Empire ran. Those are plans that have been around for a long time. Some of them are on the public record. And that's the kind of thing that Kordesman is warning about. Yevhen, too. In fact, he says they're going on to China. You know, that's why there is discussion in the region of the axis of evil. So if you want to quote the semi-official Egyptian press, they do refer to the axis of evil, referring to the U.S., Turkey, and Israel. They say that's the axis of evil. It has an advantage over the one made up by Bush's speechwriters in that at least it's an axis. It's a real axis. Iran and Iraq have been at war for 20 years, and North Korea was probably tossed in so it wouldn't look as though it's all against Muslims. But there's certainly no axis there. And there's plenty of evil to go around everywhere we look, so that's not a problem. But the U.S.-Israel-Turkey alliance is very real. That's part of the reason why the U.S. was supporting the massive atrocities in southeastern Turkey through the 90s. Incidentally, I was there a few months ago, and it's quite something. Same in Colombia, where I also was. There's places where you really could stop terrorism by not participating in it. So that's real. And the Israeli Air Force and Navy are real, and maybe these reports are correct. They're certainly being discussed in serious places. So, yeah, it's quite possible.
I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and ask the last question. I found your remarks interesting, frankly, somewhat troubling, because I have difficulty equating the motives of the United States with the motives of other countries in the world that you've kind of put in the same league that I have some difficulty doing. But let me ask you this question. If you believed that Saddam Hussein had biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons and was imminently going to use them, perhaps not on us, but on his neighbors, and with the potential of killing tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, would there be any circumstances that you would agree that it would be worthwhile for the U.S. to use military force against him?
Well, as I said, there's better options. For example, letting Iran use military force, which has enormous advantages over letting U.S. use military force, for example, those I mentioned, except for the flaw. It doesn't leave us in control, and it doesn't handle the political problems. But there certainly are cases where it might be possible. But let me repeat, nobody in the region is worried about it. Isn't that a little surprising? I mean, Kuwait and Iran, for example, both of them invaded by Saddam when he was our ally. They're not calling for the use of military force. In fact, they're opposing it. The only country in the region that's calling for military force is Israel, and they have their own reasons. The only people who seem to be afraid of this possibility, in fact, even Israeli military intelligence, the head of Israeli military intelligence recently announced that he doesn't, and they watch it pretty closely, that they don't see any nuclear threat from Iraq maybe 4 or 5 years from now, but not in the near future. He denied it. Pardon? But furthermore, see, there's a little question. I mean, I'm strongly opposed to allowing Iraq to develop nuclear weapons. That's why when George Bush and number one and his cohorts were providing assistance to Saddam in developing nuclear weapons, I was writing against it and opposing it. Give you the citations if you want. That's 1990, 1998, 1989, 1988. Yeah, I was strongly opposing the U.S. and British efforts at the time to provide Saddam with the means of developing weapons of mass destruction. I think it was horrifying. And I certainly wouldn't want it to happen now. And if we're interested in stopping it, yeah, everybody knows the way. You get inspectors back. Certainly for nuclear weapons, that's going to work. Maybe not for everything else. But just think for a second. Suppose I had nuclear weapons in my backyard, for instance. Would it be a threat to anyone? Or would it be a deterrent? Well, only under one condition, that I let people know I had them. Okay? If they're hidden in my garage, then neither a threat nor a deterrent. Right? Everybody knows this. If Saddam Hussein, in the extremely unlikely contingency that he'll develop nuclear weapons, if they were to be usable for anything, he'd have to let people know he had them. Well, the minute there's a hint that he has them, Iraq gets obliterated. Okay? Suppose there was any move made towards using them. Well, you know, they get obliterated squared. You know. That's why the people in the region, apart from not believing it, aren't afraid of it, and why they're afraid of the United States. There are reasons for, there are plenty of things to be worried about. So, for example, loose nukes getting into the hands of terrorists, that's a problem. And it's not a new one. That predates September 11th. As I mentioned, you can read technical papers in the literature, for example, in the journal International Security, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, pointing out that, close to quoting now, that this is way before 9/11, that citing government studies, which show that, which conclude that a well-planned effort to smuggle weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear weapons, into the United States would have a 90% probability of success, far higher than any missile attack with or without national missile defense. That's like 4 or 5 years ago. If you want a guidebook for terrorists, one was published about 4 years ago by MIT Press called America's Achilles Heel by three well-known strategic analysts who pointed out all kinds of ways in which terrorists could, you know, people with my limited capacity could carry out major terrorist attacks in the United States. Those things are really problems, and they're not new. I mean, we've all known about them since 1993, at least. And remember, in 1993, the offshoots of the groups that were organized by the U.S. in Afghanistan in the 80s almost blew up the World Trade Center, plus the FBI building, plus the UN buildings, plus the tunnels under the river. They had ambitious plans. According to the World Trade Center building engineers, if they had a little better planning, they would have killed tens of thousands of people. These are not new threats, you know. I mean, it's been known by everyone for years. All you have to do is read the newspapers to know it. If you read the technical literature, it's been all over. Those are problems. And if we're serious about trying to prevent, say, nuclear explosions in New York, the way you do it is by going after the loose nuke problem. Now, we know where the problem lies. It lies in the former Soviet Union and in Pakistan. And in other places where there's very weak supervision over nuclear weapons. Are we doing anything about it? No. Virtually nothing. I mean, very limited funding to try to do something about it. The latest treaty, so-called, which isn't really a treaty, it's a memorandum of understanding between Bush, between Russia and the United States on nuclear weapons, does nothing. Doesn't even reduce the number of nuclear weapons below the level it was already planned, and it provides for no supervision. Same is true of biological weapons. So, for example, just October 23rd, like just a week ago, the first committee of the United Nations, which is basically the General Assembly, passed two resolutions. One resolution calling for a reaffirmation of the 1925 Geneva Convention opposing the use of, banning the use of chemical weapons. And the second was effectively reaffirmation of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which bans the placing weapons in outer space, which we'll sooner or later call nuclear weapons. Passed almost unanimously, two countries opposed, the United States and Israel. It's actually one country because Israel's vote is reflexive. So one country opposed, the United States. The U.S. Carried out its opposition the way it usually does in these committees, but disarmament committees, by abstaining. And a U.S. abstention, like a veto, is in fact a double veto. For one thing, it kills the proposal, and for another thing, it bans it from access to the public. So there wasn't a single mention of this in any newspaper in the United States. A friend did a database search, which is normal. It's the way it usually works, on the assumption, I guess, that it's not a good idea to let citizens know of what's being done to end biology's only experiment with higher intelligence. This goes on all the time. But those are real threats. I mean, if we oppose, just shortly before that, the U.S. opposed any steps, even 10 years in the future, to add some enforcement devices to the biological weapons treaty that the U.S. at the last minute refused to ratify, endorse. Yeah, those are real threats. You know, we want to do something about them. Yeah, put teeth in them. And carry out our responsibilities under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which we signed. The Non-Proliferation Treaty commits those who have nuclear weapons to good faith efforts to get rid of them. Okay? Yeah, put teeth in that and stop stimulating the proliferation of nuclear weapons, as Kenneth Waltz pointed out, by countries who are going to feel they need them as a deterrent. Yeah, those are all concrete things that we can do to increase our own security.
Thank you very much, Professor Chomsky. You have a real good feel. You're very popular.